or little ticket. If you want to have a copy of any of the sessions that are being presented this weekend, you can purchase tapes of those outside in the lobby. They're $7 each. I want to first let you know that if you have questions at the end of our two speakers, that there's a microphone here and you may line up and please speak your questions into the microphone. This session is being broadcast over radio. I will introduce both of our speakers and then they can talk to you. Our first speaker is Levi Peterson. He grew up in Snowflake, Arizona, which he says explains almost everything. He received his BA and MA at BYU and his doctorate at the University of Utah. He has been teaching English at Weber State University since 1965 and is currently the chair of the English department there. He is the author of such popular fiction books as The Canyons of Grace, Night Soil, Backslider, and the autobiography of Juanita Brooks. As Mr. Peterson said to me, brevity is important. As I relinquish the microphone to him, we shall see if he really means it. Lou Wallace, Dr. Wallace, was raised on a dairy farm outside Idaho Falls. He attended Ricks College during the Depression, obtaining a degree in scientific pharmacy at Idaho State University and an MD from USC through his seven-year enlistment in the Navy. He went on to a mission in Germany and has an interesting tale to relate about how he and his companion were the last two out of Prussia. Dr. Wallace received a flight surgeon certificate from the Air Force, after which he went into general practice of medicine in L.A. for 40 years. He is married to Nola and has four children. Now retired, he spends his summers in Idaho gardening and playing the handyman and carpenter. He confines his writing, he told me, to letters to the editor, which he either sends or leaves on his computers if they were done in anger. Now, here's Levi Peterson.
My paper is entitled The Art of Dissent Among the Mormons. Dissent, I assume, derives from nonconformity. Nonconformity implying an inability to adhere to official standards, and dissent implying an expression of that inability for purposes of protest or defiance. Both of these closely related terms will be important in the following essay, though my emphasis will finally be upon dissent, which among the Mormons should be an ameliorative art, not merely a wild and aimless exfoliation of disillusioned members. For many Latter-day Saints, dissent is equivalent to apostasy. We have to get over that semantic imprecision. Apostates are dissenters, but so are constructive inside critics who informally constitute Mormonism's loyal opposition. I might point out that an unorganized loyal opposition has always existed within the Mormon Church. However, the concept of authority as an all-sufficient source of truth and morality is so strong among the Mormons that the contributions of constructive criticism are almost always ignored and often bluntly denied. The going theory in the church is that the gospel has been given whole and perfect by heaven, and if you take exception to it, you are unrighteous. There aren't supposed to be differing points of view or opinions. Nonconformity is seen as a moral aberration, and dissent as sedition. The evidence of history, however, is that the gospel isn't whole and perfect at any given time. The church does, in fact, change for the better, and the dissent of loyal members can be a rich source of improvement and ought to be managed with tolerance and finesse. My premise is that, given the laws of human nature, nonconformity is inevitable, and while it can be suppressed, it can't be eliminated. Too strong a repression brings the church into violation of its own principle of free agency. Furthermore, a more tolerant management of dissent will ultimately salvage more people for Mormonism than a repressive policy. The greatest sloughing off of members from Mormonism occurs among the newly converted. Perhaps it is ironic that those most recently touched by the experience of testimony fall away with astonishing ease. Any missionary has observed this phenomenon over and over. Those most likely to stick with Mormonism are born and raised in it. But even among these, there is a considerable falling away. My remarks won't have much bearing on the retention of new converts, but might prove helpful in keeping those born into Mormonism or domesticated to its culture over a long period of time. First interest is how nonconformists adapt, whether as they discover their own nonconformity, they suffer in timid silence, or whether they abandon the religion altogether, or whether they define a comfortable new relationship with Mormonism that involves at least a modicum of dissent. Needless to say, it is the latter accommodation that I favor, and I would be grateful if anything I say here helps someone make that accommodation. I will first consider the silent, hidden nonconformist, who is a nonconformist only in mind and spirit and not in action. I am struck over and over by the seemingly trivial nature of the nonconformity that afflicts the conscience of many practicing Latter-day Saints whom I know well. A failure to attend Sunday school regularly, an addiction to Sunday sports on TV, a taste for caffeinated soft drinks, and so on. Once a woman came to my campus office seeking advice about a family history she was writing. In her history, she had felt compelled to recount her grandfather's abuse of one of his plural wives, yet was now contemplating the probable censure of her mother and many other members of her extended family who prided themselves on the perfection of their ancestors' polygamous marriage. This woman's conscience and religious sentiments sided with the probable censure of her family. The fact of a grandfather's abuse could not outweigh her obligation to put the gloss of success upon her family's pioneer past. Though the issue seemed inconsequential to me, in her own feelings, the woman was flirting with apostasy. There was little I could do other than lend a sympathetic ear. And at last report, she had decided to abandon the project. There are, of course, many among the Mormons who quietly suppress a nonconformity of a more serious nature. Another visitor to my office was a woman who refused to reveal her name or even the city in which she resided. She had a half-written novel about a Mormon woman who was a wife and mother in a stable family immersed in a church-oriented lifestyle, but who happened to have a lesbian sexual preference. The character, she admitted, was modeled upon herself. She claimed she had never engaged in lesbian activity, but was unmistakably drawn in her sexual desire to her own gender. She intended to publish under a pseudonym, but feared that the circumstances of the novel would betray her identity. She struck me as grim and desperate, and she never trusted me enough to put the manuscript in my hands, not even in her presence. I referred her to a woman prominent in the Mormon feminist movement in whom I knew she could confide. Shortly, she stopped meeting with either of us, and I can only assume she had made a decision not to endanger her concealment. The many expressions of self-doubt I have heard among Mormons during moments of candor persuade me that hidden nonconformists abound, numbering as many as perhaps a fourth of what is called the active Mormon population. Alone in their awareness of a supposed inadequacy of faith or motivation, they continue in the communion of the saints, enjoying the comforts and pleasures of a church-oriented social life. Undoubtedly, many of them, perhaps most of them, conceive themselves rather than the church to be at fault, and therefore suffer a quiet, persistent guilt over their nonconformity. Others perceive their nonconformity to be inevitable and just and smolder with anger over the necessity of suppressing it. All suffer from a violated integrity. Integrity consists of an uncompromised conscience, and its possession is greatly to be desired. Unluckily, only a few in any population live out their lives without being forced to truckle in some manner to an imposed mode of behavior. I come now to open and known nonconformists whose violations of the commandments result in a greater or lesser degree of alienation from the community of the church. Among such nonconformists must be counted the backslider or Jack Mormon, the Mormon who believes but doesn't practice with a sufficient zeal. Backsliders are so common that a discussion of them may seem an exercise in the obvious, yet the following example helps make a not always recognized point. A close dear relative of mine is married to a Gentile, and most of his friends are Gentiles or other backsliders. He smokes, drinks coffee, and goes on occasional drinking binges. He hasn't paid tithing since he was a boy, and he engages in the proverbial act of darkening the door of a church only for funerals. Yet if I impugn the Mormon church or its doctrines, he politely and accurately corrects me. I would not be surprised to find him earnestly preaching Mormonism in a bar. He is a nonconformist, but not a dissenter. He has no quarrel with the Mormon church. He sees himself rather than the church as being at fault, and it's entirely possible he expects someday to repent and return to the fold. There is an enormous nether church among the Mormons, an informal body of believers alienated from the social life of the organized church by their nonconformity. I have tried to make a case for the authenticity of their religious experience in my story, Night Soil. The members of this nether church are profoundly Christian, revering God and yearning for salvation. They believe in the Book of Mormon, in the prophetical character of Joseph Smith, and the present president of the church. But lacking the will or ability to obey the commandments, they do not feel welcome among the righteous. If backsliders seem comfortable in their nonconformity, I for one favor leaving them in peace. Instead of plotting ways to rehabilitate them, churchgoers should offer them friendship without attaching the price tag of obedience to the commandments. If they believe, they are as truly Mormon as any practicing church member. Obviously, many nonconformists eventually become as totally disengaged from Mormonism, so totally disengaged from Mormonism that they can no longer be called Mormons of any sort. During my boyhood, there was a wonderfully defiant chiropractor in my hometown. He had lost an eye and a hand in a mining accident, and he spoke in a deep, gravelly voice. He was married to a Mormon woman who didn't attend church. Rumor had it that he himself had once been baptized. If so, the rite had not had its desired effect. Although his doctoring skills were valued by both the righteous and the unrighteous, he was a rallying point for the town wastrels and ruffians who sought his company and valued his counsel. He smoked cigars, the fumes of which he accused the town's righteous of enjoying by walking downwind from him. He told many an unsavory story and made many a pious neighbor the butt of his jokes, breaking into hoarse guffaws when he had finished. Of a pious schoolteacher with a numerous progeny, he was said to have declared, "For hell's sake, the next kid that schoolteacher has goes for tithing." This man contributed enormously to the honesty of religion in our town by pointing out and thereby helping correct the foibles of the righteous. Any community of Mormons could profit from the presence of such a satirist. In their search for disengagement from a religion they no longer favor, many nonconforming Mormons simply disappear from the Mormon scene. They often remove themselves geographically from Mormon population centers, or if they remain in Mormon country, they associate exclusively with non-Mormon friends and organizations. In time, they themselves become non-Mormons. While a graduate student at the University of Utah, I became close friends with a young woman on her way out of Mormonism. She derived from a pioneer family in southern Utah and was for the moment involved in a marriage that had been solemnized in a temple. The immediate source of her disillusionment with Mormonism was the behavior of a member of the general authorities, from whom she and her husband rented a basement apartment for a period. She frequently overheard this man in such an unethical conduct of business over a phone in the basement hallway that his ecclesiastical office was discredited in her eyes, and so too was the entire religion of which he was an important representative. In time, my friend divorced her Mormon husband, married a non-Mormon, and moved east, where she has raised her children in a secular environment. I will cite another who evolved through I'll skip a paragraph here on the root of alienation being what I call disillusioned idealism. I will cite another who evolved through a disillusioned nonconformity to a total disengagement from Mormonism. During the fall of 1952, he was my instructor in colonial American literature, my first course as an English major at BYU. He welcomed me in his office, and his independence of mind influenced the nonconformity into which I myself would later grow. He was among the swearing elders who met at the University of Utah campus during the early 1950s. By the time I had returned from my mission in 1957, he had left BYU and had requested that his name be removed from the rolls of the Mormon Church. At a party one evening, he told me about his departure from Mormonism. It seems his disillusionment was of an intellectual character. His rage accumulated, while on point after point, he became convinced that Mormon belief failed to meet the test of scientific reason. At last, he wrote a letter requesting removal of his name from church rolls. His brother-in-law, a member of the Quorum of the Twelve, tried to dissuade him. His eyes flashed as he narrated this attempt to turn him from his purpose, and he struck his palm forcefully and cried, "By God, I'll not abide a trammeled mind." He also told of conveying the fact of his apostasy to his aging father, who, he said, accepted his decision calmly and without reproof. But at the mention of his father, the composure of this truculent, tough-minded mentor of mine broke, and his eyes filled with tears, confirming what almost everyone knows, that if you've been raised a Mormon, disengagement isn't easy. There's no use fretting over the departure from the ranks of Mormonism of people like the two I've just described. You have to let them go with your blessing, and by all means do your best to stay in touch. The lapsed Mormons about whom I worry are those who seem never to find another emotional home. And when strangers show up in my campus office saying they just want to have a talk because they've read some of my liberal off-the-wall stuff, I know I'm in the presence of hearts in turmoil. And I hope I'll say something that will help them stay with the religion of their childhood. I'm somewhat taken aback by my own impulse to salvage non-conforming Mormons. I have little interest in proselyting Gentiles who are happily ensconced in their own worldview, whatever they might be. My interest in helping people stay in the fold has something to do with the intensity of my own sense of belonging. For all my apparently compulsive backsliding, I remain profoundly and ineradicably a Mormon. One evening as I turned north at the corner of Hotel Utah, I saw late sunlight on Moroni and the spires of the temple, and the strongest surge of belonging swept through me. I said to myself, "This is my place, and these are my people, now and for as long as I live." I recall an attempt to salvage a would-be nonconformist of a sort I have not so far not mentioned, a Mormon fundamentalist. One summer in my hometown, I met a friend from school days who had seen my name in the program of the latest Sunstone Symposium. He asked me to listen to a friend of his. The next day, we called on this man, whose study shelves were lined with fundamentalist books. After brief formalities, this man began to preach fundamentalism to me. He decried the church's abandonment of the practice of plural marriage and the ceremony of the Second Temple blessing, and said the keys of authority within the Mormon church were lost, to be restored in the near future by one mighty and strong. He was erudite and eloquent and possessed a raw natural charisma of a strength I have never encountered in any other person. I could easily understand how my friend from school days had fallen into an orbit about his magnetic personality. The next day I asked another friend whether the town was troubled by fundamentalists, and she named these two. So that night when they called at my mother's house to further our discussion, I stopped playing the role of passive listener and spoke up. I said that though I was honored they would confide in me, the mere fact that I had appeared in the program of a Sunstone Symposium did not mean that I was hospitable to their particular breed of dissent. I said I was a liberal Mormon and therefore on the opposite pole of disagreement with the official church. I said I particularly did not favor nonconformity that would abolish the presently constituted government of the church, believing as I do that the vitality that derives from a large and thriving church unified under the first presidency and Quorum of the Twelve serves the interests of Mormonism far better than a host of small warring churches. I told them that their proselytism in behalf of fundamentalism was a matter of common knowledge in town, and it would therefore be only a matter of time before one or both would be called before a church court to answer. I reminded them that neither sexual sins nor felonies were as sure to result in excommunication as an espousal of fundamentalism. I turned expressly to my friend from school days and asked, "Are you absolutely sure you want to leave the church of your childhood, the church your numerous loved ones and friends belong to?" As for my friend, he was visibly alarmed by what I had said, as I had hoped he would be, for I sincerely believed he would not flourish emotionally while leading the clandestine, exile life of a practicing fundamentalist. I'm happy to report that today that these two men continue in the communion of their respective wards, owing, however, I think, not to my brief exhortation to but more lasting influences. I come now to the question of what nonconformists might do to honor their own integrity yet maintain their allegiance to Mormonism. I would like to suggest a deliberate, conscious procedure, an amplification, if you please, of the art of dissent among the Mormons. I will observe that nonconforming Mormons need two communities, the one provided by the official church and another much smaller and less formal provided by friends and fellow nonconformists. I will discuss how nonconformists might comport themselves within these two communities in light of their differing opportunities and standards. Presumably, all nonconformists begin as more or less accepted members of a functioning ward organized by the official church. In my opinion, it is desirable to maintain that status if it is at all possible, though as I have indicated above, many a true Mormon never darkens a church door. The delicate question arises just how far they may go in expressing their nonconformity in the presence of their more obedient brothers and sisters. Accepting the fact that a certain degree of conformity is mandatory, they must judge the tolerance point of their particular ward and not exceed it. If I may, I will cite the church-attending members of my own ward, whom I conceive to be average active Mormons, committed to the standards of the church, a little doubtful of their own salvation, eager to convert the non-member and reactivate the backslider, and very concerned with the sick and unfortunate among them. I feel an immense love for these people and admire and respect their valiant struggle with life's vicissitude. They speak to me warmly, and they accept me as a home teacher and as a once-a-month instructor in the high priest group. As I have said elsewhere, I worship vicariously through their prayers, hymns, and ceremonies. Yet many of them, if not all, know that I am a backslider. They know I drink coffee, don't pay tithing, am willing to mow my lawn on the Sabbath, write salacious books, and sleep in church without apology. Declining church calls politely yet firmly is one kind of nonconformity that I believe could be much more practiced by church members than at present. I will point out that in turning down a call, it is necessary to think of a morally acceptable excuse. I remember many years ago that the president of my elder's quorum asked for volunteers to go to the hospital that afternoon to administer to the sick. Elder after elder gave a viable excuse. When it came my turn, I said simply I didn't want to go. The president, a somewhat older man with unruly Scottish hair, stared at me in disbelief. Not wanting to go isn't a good reason, he said, and went on to scold me in an embarrassing way. I learned a lesson from the incident, and ever since I have always provided the mandatory moral excuse. Another matter is the degree to which unconventional views on doctrine may be expressed during lessons, whether by teachers or by class members. As I have said, I serve as instructor of my high priest group on one Sunday each month. I accept forthwith the duty of not antagonizing the members of the class, of keeping, that is, within the boundaries of acceptable assertion, even if, as is often the case, I am led to support and affirm doctrines for which I personally have little taste. I attempt to exercise a liberalizing spirit entirely through questions, never through assertions, and I am often surprised at just how liberal some otherwise staid high priest will prove on some single point of doctrine. I will say, however, that my primary objective as a teacher is simply to overcome the stultifying boredom inherent in a lesson manual run dry of any novelty or conflict by the vigilant hands of correlation. Fear of nonconformity has made Mormon lesson manuals for adults numbingly juvenile in their content. During the month just passed, I led a discussion on the necessity of teaching our children and grandchildren to marry in the temple, a topic I approached with a sense of deficiency since my own daughter had just married outside the temple less than a month earlier. As is my custom, I first paid my respects to the official doctrine on the matter by summarizing it and reading several supporting passages of Scripture. With that duty done, I went on to some of the interesting implications of the doctrine. I said that so far as I knew, most other Christians believe in the asexuality of the immortal soul. Is it true, I asked, that Mormons believe that immortal spouses will engage in sexual intercourse? All agreed on the procreation of spirit children by celestial couples. Whether that would involve sexual union as known on earth was debated inconclusively. I asked whether it is just to require marriage for the highest exaltation. Some said that the unmarried righteous could at least inherit the celestial kingdom. Another pointed out that an unmarried woman might be given a husband during the millennium. No one seemed to think an unmarried man deserved such consideration. What about the fact that when a couple married in the temple divorced civilly, the man can marry again in the temple, whereas his divorced wife can't? Several agreed that this was wrong. Someone defended the practice, saying that it was the nature of polygamy to allow this. A younger man said it was still wrong, and he cited the example of close relatives. In my opinion, the important thing in such a discussion is not the expression of any particular point of view, but the act of thinking about problems and perplexities. So fearful has the official church become of controversy that simple elemental thinking has all but disappeared from its classes and pulpits. I turn now to the second community which the nonconforming Mormon might belong, the much smaller and less formal community provided by friends and fellow nonconformists. The values of participation in such a community are obvious. Nonconformists will not feel so isolated nor so compromised in their integrity. They will be reassured that they are not morally deformed. They will more readily find a model for how to reconcile their conforming and nonconforming selves. Furthermore, they will be more likely to exercise a liberalizing influence in their home wards. One level of involvement in a community of nonconformity is relatively unnoticeable and offers less hardy spirits the prospect of freedom from censure and discipline. This is the community created through ordinary social relationships of a self-selected sort. Like-minded persons seek each other out and become social familiars. Trusting in one another's discretion, they can relax and express their nonconformity, even to the point of making jokes about doctrines and practices of the church with which they disagree. I'm aware of many such small social circles. I'm thinking, for example, of about a dozen women who compose a circle of friends in Salt Lake. Some of these women are married and others divorced. Some attend church and others don't. They go out with one another and meet regularly to discuss books they have read. They are brash and ribald, and they make fun of the affectations of authority. They are disillusioned with what the church permits them as women to do, and their group finds its unity in their anger over the status of women. It is possible some of them will drift out of Mormonism. For the moment, their small self-created society helps keep them in. There's another level of involvement in a community of dissent which is more tangible and therefore more hazardous and likely to generate conflict with the official church. There are visible centers of dissent, as we might call them, consisting of newsletters, magazines, journals, books, publishing firms, scholarly societies, action committees, lecture series, and symposiums. Many individuals stand behind these manifestations: lecturers, authors, publishers, editors, officers, board members, professors, and so on. These centers of dissent are by no means uniform in their degree of nonconformity and protest. Some are at clear odds with the church. A well-known polygamist publishes and sells fundamentalist books which propound the illegitimacy and office of the First Presidency and Quorum of the Twelve. A hardy pair of ex-Mormons who have become born-again Christians run a ministry aimed at the utter extinction of Mormonism, which they consider an abomination in the sight of the Lord. But many others think of themselves as voicing only mild and corrective protests, or as engaging in legitimate scholarly and critical writing that should not even be construed as dissent. This last variety of dissenter I think of as the Mormon liberal, and I have a special case to make for this character type. It is the liberal who tends to favor tolerance of fundamentalists or anti-Mormons and who helps create a forum wherein their ideas can be more readily expressed. It is, in fact, around the nucleus of liberal Mormons that a unified community of dissent has coalesced from an aggregation of disparate and antithetical nonconformists. I use the word liberal without apology. The very opprobrium attached to the word in the minds of religious and political conservatives makes it attractive to me. I am not adverse to near synonyms like the words intellectual or Liahona. However, I like liberal best because it suggests an attitude of promoting change within the church, change of a progressive sort, change in the direction of the civilized values evolving in the world at large. The conservative main body of Mormons, like other conservative Christians, insulate themselves from the unsettling duty of keeping up with civilizing change by dismissing the large civilization around them as too secular and fraught with human error. In doing this, they fail to distinguish the good from the bad in the world around them, and in effect cement themselves into bad attitudes and practices from their own cultural past. There are many visible centers of liberal Mormonism. Dialogue, Sunstone, and Exponent 2 are flourishing liberal periodicals. Signature Books has become a large and significant publisher of liberal Mormon books. The Mormon History Association, counting hundreds of members, stands for an objective study of the Mormon past. A variety of organizations create forums for a reflective consideration of Mormon values, doctrines, and rituals. Most notable among these is the Sunstone Foundation, which fields an annual Salt Lake Sunstone Theological Symposium and a variety of lesser symposia in other parts of the nation. I love the diversity of opinion that is represented at a Sunstone Symposium. Despite the antipathy of the liberal towards the fundamentalist, fundamentalist publishing firms will be found to have set up book displays at the symposium. Avowed anti-Mormons circulate freely, and there are presentations by ministers of other faiths and by scholars from the RLDS Church, to say nothing, as we have seen at this symposium, of representatives of the Hindu religion. For many years, the Orthodox point of view of the main church was also well represented. It now appears the general authorities of the church don't want that point of view represented at the symposium for fear it might appear that the church endorses opposing views as well. As a result, participation by BYU professors has fallen from 82 at the 1991 symposium to only 19 at the present one. For all the diversity to be found in a Sunstone symposium, the general spirit to be found there is orthodox, faith-promoting, and committed to Mormonism. During March just past, my wife and I attended the regional Sunstone Symposium held in Washington, D.C. A couple from the D.C. area picked us up at the airport just as the so-called blizzard of 91 set in. The next morning, we made our way over nearly deserted, windswept streets to the campus of the American University, where the symposium went forward with an attendance almost as numerous as usual. At lunch, I listened to a discussion between two bishops of inner-city wards composed chiefly of racial minorities. They spoke of ministering to the spiritual needs of Latter-day Saints who were third- and fourth-generation welfare recipients, with neither prospects nor plans for changing their cultural status. I was moved by the immense sympathy of these two men, and of their wives, too, who joined fully in the discussion, for the economically disadvantaged saints whom they served. By evening, the blizzard had intensified and spread across the entire eastern third of the nation, and many in attendance learned by radio and TV that the expressways and airports by which they planned to return home were closed. Yet as we assembled in the plenary session and fervently sang "The Spirit of God Like a Fire is Burning," our collective anxiety lifted. And when in closing we sang "God Be With You Till We Meet Again," it was as if indeed God's peace had descended on us, and we went away into the storm strengthened rather than weakened in our commitment to Mormonism. If, as I have said, the net effect of the liberal movement is the creation of a collective forum for Mormon issues in which all stripes of opinion may find expression, the question remains whether such a collective forum is advantageous or disadvantageous to the church at large. I understand and even sympathize with the view that alternate voices, as they have been called, undermine the grand mission of converting the world to Mormonism. But I think it fully is likely that, given that we live in a real rather than an ideal world, the ranks of Mormonism will remain fuller if the liberal agenda is tolerated, even if it is not endorsed by the official church. Countenancing alternate voices is not the equivalent of agreeing with them. There is greater safety in an environment where dissident ideas are allowed to clash in an open forum rather than in an atmosphere of repression where dissident ideas do not disappear but reign in the subterranean domain of rumor and folklore. In the end, informed reason will make members of the church less vulnerable to the turbulence of dissent than will a sheltered, censored ignorance. It must be recognized that sometimes the church does respond positively to the spiritual nonconformity of its membership. The widespread dismay of Mormons in general over discrimination against blacks surely had much to do with the hope-inspiring revelation of 1978, whereby the priesthood was extended to all worthy males regardless of race. But at present, it seems the official church has taken up the cudgel against liberal sentiment among its members with great fervor. The causes against which the membership are especially warned in a recent speech by a member of the Quorum of Twelve are feminism, the dignity of homosexuality, and the open forum of dissent created by the liberal movement. Of these, the most crucial by far is the latter, because all other liberal causes, as well as non-liberal causes, are disseminated and propounded through that forum. The weapons employed by the church against participation in an open forum are simple but effective. Sermons and speeches by general authorities immunize the large obedient majority of members who accept the judgment of their leaders as definitive. As for the would-be dissenters themselves, sometimes a simple inquiry from a stake president suffices to endure silence. Well, I'll skip over that. You know that list as well as I do. I will consider briefly the application of some of these weapons against a couple of my friends identified with one of the proscribed causes named above, feminism. The issue is whether women are to be allowed to make decisions within the kingdom of God. Given their indisputed competence to do so, it seems likely that it is men rather than God who persist in denying them this right. During the heady months following the priesthood revelation of 1978, many believed the empowerment of women within the Mormon Church lay only a decade or two in the future. Undoubtedly, women will one day hold the priesthood in the Mormon Church and serve as bishops, stake presidents, and apostles. This is because the tide of civilization is in the direction of the enfranchisement of women, and sooner or later Mormonism will stop rowing against that tide. Nonetheless, it is obvious this civilized change will occur much later than many of us had hoped. A close friend of mine, a woman journalist who covered the excommunication of Sonia Johnson, returned to Utah profoundly disillusioned by the lack of due process in the proceedings of the church court. This journalist wrote a couple of articles that were published in independent magazines and quickly found her own membership in jeopardy. For several years, she and her husband lived in a state of great anxiety. Associating with numerous friends in the liberal Mormon community, she continued to speak and write in a liberal vein. Though she still appears among liberal Mormons, the sheer enervation of incessant conflict has led her to withdraw more and more completely from the Mormon scene. She is intelligent, loyal, and naturally reverent, and I regret that she is offered so little comfort by the religion of her youth. I'll skip the next example for sake of time. What advice might I have for the two courageous battlers I have described and for all others who have dared become open dissenters? What amplifications can I finally make on the art of dissent among the Mormons? By all means, liberal Mormons should maintain their connection with a home ward if at all possible. They should strengthen themselves by singing the old familiar hymns and engaging in the comforting rituals. They should influence the others in their ward with liberal ideas, if only in oblique and subtle ways. And if this engenders a certain sense of deviousness arising from keeping one's involvement in liberal things hidden from one's brothers and sisters in a ward, so be it. There are worse things than a little hypocrisy. No one is without it, however perfect he or she may pretend to be. To those whose livelihood depends upon the church, I would say most emphatically, never lose your job for a liberal cause. The contribution of any single person to vocal dissent is limited in importance. You are making a contribution simply by making sure that a payroll position is held down by a person of liberal sentiments. So consider withdrawing from the ranks of open dissent if it seems your job is in jeopardy. If you teach at BYU and your dean rumbles about the dangers of attending the Sunstone Symposium, don't go, for heaven's sake. Catch up on what happened there while socializing with your liberal friends who are employed in more benign climates. Count on living to fight another day. It's much better to be a living dog than a dead lion. There'll be other times and occasions for spreading liberal ideas. That's a very, very important point to remember. The battle for the liberalization of Mormonism is perpetual. It'll not be over soon. You need to hunker down for the long haul. Finally, if your particular identity and indignation demand a course of action that seems fated to lead to excommunication, well, God bless you and give you courage. Even here I have some advice, which is that excommunication is no reason for withdrawing from Mormonism. I fancy that if I were excommunicated by a church court on a weekday, I'd be back sleeping in sacrament meeting on the following Sunday. Presumably, I'd be relieved of my duties as home teacher and occasional instructor of the high priest group. Presumably, I'd not be called on to pray or preach, but those are petty losses. I'd continue to partake of the sacrament unless I were expressly forbidden to do so. In that case, I'd attend meeting from time to time in a ward where I wasn't known and would partake of the sacrament there. Certainly, I'd join in lustily in singing hymns, and I'd attend church socials and chat as always with my friends after meeting. And, of course, out on the battlefront of liberal Mormonism, I'd go on doing whatever it was that had got me excommunicated in the first place. And then, during the millennium, when God rather than man will be my judge, angels can superintend my rebaptism into the church, from which I shouldn't have been cast out in the first place. Though as a corporation, the church may be owned by its legally constituted officers, as a moral community, Mormonism is beyond ownership. You and I belong to it if we choose to belong. I, for one, do choose to belong. I'll not let another human being, however highly placed, drive me from Mormonism. I'll not let an archaic doctrine or practice drive me out. I choose to stay where my heart is and to vent my disapproval of uncivilized beliefs and practices through a quiet but unrelenting resistance. There's a place within Mormonism for the loyal dissenter, and I, for one, intend to occupy it. Thank you.
Thank you, Levi. I now give you Lou Wallace.
I really should, in response to Levi's paper, just say amen and then shut down, because I agree with so much in this very well-given paper. I thought I might add a few personal experiences, however. I grew up in the church convinced that dissent was the necessary and accepted normal behavior. I'm not so naive now, but still feel that dissent is absolutely necessary if we are to actually have continual revelation and progress. Revelation implies change, a change coming after prayerful study and inquiry, often provoked by dissent and requiring repentance. For example, apparently Emma's dislike of the spittoons in the school of the prophets helped us get our word of wisdom, and I could cite many other examples. When all the members think alike and dissent is suppressed, no one is doing much thinking or inquiring or revealing. The Lord has warned us against complacency, the accedia sin, which has become a virtue, the all in is well in Zion conceit. I admit enjoying the role of a dissenter a little bit, of provoking new and wider ranging ways of thinking. Today, I purposely wore my unofficial Mormon robes, the dark suit, the white shirt, and the tie. But if you will look closely, you will notice this is the Wallace tartan. Scots, what have a Wallace bled? You know the poem. This is the Wallace family crest. The sword in the upraised arm proclaims pro-liberty. These are my inherited emblems of dissent. You may be looking at a strange creature. I may be by choice the only 70-year-old 70 since B.H. Roberts. Sometimes dissent will give you some strange positive results rather than negative. I was something of a dissenter in my medical practice and family practice. I made house calls. I did hospice care work. I did autopsies on my deceased patients. And strangely enough, my mild dissension caused me to be accidentally immortalized when one of my patients, Eugene Roddenberry, used me as the model for the crusty Dr. McCoy in the Star Trek series. And he himself told me that. In striving toward perfection, we should all be dissenters. Dissent against ignorance and its errors, for it's impossible for a man to be saved in ignorance. Dissent against mediocrity. Homogenized Mormons should not be our goal. E pluribus unum should be our church motto as well as our national motto, and this is best translated from the Latin as unity with diversity. I don't mean being an activist, but we should not merely just suffer in silence and vote with our feet by leaving. We should dissent, but our dissent should be as constructive as possible. I have dissented on many issues in my life, from mediocre anonymous lesson manuals to the processes of organic and inorganic evolution, the withholding of the priesthood from the Negro, birth and population control and abortion, and the unrighteous use of authority. For 30 years, I protested the Negro priesthood denial. When the revelation came, two stake presidents phoned me to tell me about it. I assume they were also pleased, and not just happy to get me off their backs. As Levi pointed out, dissent can and should be mild, gentle, like using the Socratic method of teaching by asking questions. Avoid confrontation wherever possible. I'm fortunate in the tolerance shown me by the high priest quorums I attend and pleased that they like my stimulation. One said to me, "When the soft stuff has gone down, you bring out the beef jerky." I'm also fortunate to have lived when you could personally mingle with church presidents and apostles, could write them letters concerning your dissent problems and receive a personal letter back. I think how times have changed. When I was in the mission home, which was just north of the Beehive House, and we went through the temple for the first time, Elder West and I had a whole lot of questions. So what did we do? We headed for the church office building and cornered Apostle Callis and said, "Now what gives here?" And the good apostle very patiently was answering our questions, but it would have taken all afternoon to cover all the questions we had. So we thanked him and took off for class and cornered Dick West's stake president that night to have our questions answered. As I say, times and attitudes have changed. Evidence is in Reconciliations by Dr. John A. Widsoe became Joseph Fielding Smith, Answers Your Questions. The price of dissent is very high for the conscientious believer when they find themselves in opposition to church authority or dogma and find disapproval, peer pressure, and even overt action taken against them. They should, if possible, anticipate this and perhaps decrease their vulnerability. I find solace in the prophet Joseph's remark that our church had no dogma, no beliefs to which we had to subscribe or be kicked out of the church. He and other leaders taught that the gospel welcomed and encompassed all truth, regardless of source. I didn't, as a student, have to compartmentalize my mind like my Catholic roommate. I could mix my religion and my science. We should remember that the church leaders are men. They are good men. But they're still men, and they're subject to the limitations and weaknesses of men. They put their pants on one leg at a time, just as you and I do. And I can personally testify to this, for I entered the bedroom just as President George Albert Smith was changing his trousers. The Lord called our...